No, you tell it.
No, you.
I'm not telling it.
You should totally tell it.
Well, you should tell it.
No, you tell it. No, You Tell It is a series that switches up the storytelling. So each performer writes a true life tale and then, switching with a partner, performs the other person's story, giving everyone involved the chance to share their own stories and experience someone else's. Today's pair of Two on Tuesday stories come from our show, Lock and Key. First up, Ryan Holmes' What Am I Doing Here? Is a story about negotiating friendship and Los Angeles traffic, with the bonus of relationship advice from none other than the infamous Tony Orlando. Here's Valerie David performing Ryan's story.
I'm not sure if you've ever lived in Los Angeles, but it has a tendency to make you feel trapped. Once you're there, there is no getting out. At least not until you figure out why the hell you're there in the first place. I moved to Los Angeles in the fall of 2005 as an aspiring actor. I made the mistake of never visiting LA before moving there. Upon seeing my first palm tree as I descended from the airplane stairlift at Burbank Airport, I knew this wasn't the place for me. But I knew I had to be there. I just wasn't exactly sure why yet. Los Angeles is a weird place. No one knows quite where it begins and quite where it ends. You could be deep in the valley in Woodland Hills or way out in the ocean in Santa Monica, and yet you're somehow still in LA. I grew very tired very quickly of being in my car, stuck in traffic for what seemed like most of every day. I spent so much time in my car that I started to get sick of all my music. Oh. How long would it be until I got tired of my favorite album of all time? TP2.com by R. Kelly. LA has many wonderful people, but the abundance of the phonies really wore on my patience. I'm from the East Coast. Home, you don't play that game. The other thing about LA, it's a one-industry town with an absurd amount of fit, beautiful people. I knew I had to get in better shape. The pressure of living all the way across the country, the competitiveness of my industry, the perennial vehicular congestion, and the beautiful, phony people proved too much for me to bear. But there was one phosphorescent light amidst the chaos. When I got to LA, I identified as a heterosexual, though I never felt quite comfortable with it. Shortly after I got there, my friend Ignacio introduced me to his friends Steve and Bryce. I didn't really know Bryce or notice him much at first, as Steve was classically the handsome one. However, I noticed how much Bryce smiled and laughed and seemed to be genuinely enjoying life. The next time we met at Ignacio's apartment in Culver City, which took me about 3 hours to get there from Burbank, I mentioned that I didn't have anyone with whom to see the 50 Cent movie Get Rich or Die Trying. And Bryce said, I'll go. And we made plans. He showed up at the Santa Monica Promenade the following Saturday in an adorable Newsies-like hat and a Beatles t-shirt. That night, I got a better look at his dimple and his big brown eyes and his thick, kissable lips, and I was instantly smitten. Though Steve was the classically handsome one, I must have forgotten that I'm way more attracted to pretty boys. And Bryce was the prettiest boy I had ever seen. From that point forward, Bryce and I did everything together. We played epic tennis matches, went on bike rides, did coffee weekly, went to dinners and movies every weekend, and we even did the unthinkable in Los Angeles. We took in Broadway shows. We hung out so much that we joked that we were a couple, and we were sure the barista at Earth Cafe in Santa Monica thought we were boyfriends. Can you say barista when it's not Starbucks? But we weren't boyfriends. We were best friends. We were straight. The problem was, I wanted us to be boyfriends, and I sure wasn't straight. I had fallen for boys before, but I never really talked about it with anyone. Also, they were always straight, so I never really saw a reason to change my lifestyle for someone who could never want me. However, when it came to Bryce, lines got blurred, and not in the rapey Robin Thicke way. I wanted to turn our fake boyfriend status into a reality. With everything we did and everything we said, it almost seemed possible. I was seeing a therapist at the time. I was living in Los Angeles, so there was the reason. I told her I needed to talk to her about something. Imagine that, talking to a therapist about one of your problems. I told her the feelings I was having for Bryce and explained the nature of our relationship. She encouraged me to tell him about how I felt. Even she thought Bryce felt something back. But do I take her advice or not? I mean, this was my best friend. This was the dude who helped pull me through some deep depression and some of my most severe anxiety, and moreover, the guy with whom I did everything. Did I risk our friendship to tell him this? I mean, how will he react? Maybe he'll freak out. Will things be different if I tell him? Of course they will. But will it be worse? Will they be better? Will we be boyfriends? Unlikely, but I had to find out. Do I potentially jeopardize the very thing that made living in LA remotely bearable? But at the time, losing Bryce's friendship meant losing nearly everything. Bear in mind that I was still hiding my sexuality from virtually everybody. At first, only my therapist knew, but I was agonizing over Bryce. So I had to talk to friends about it. I resorted to switching pronouns and saying she for he and her for him. To this day, I still wonder why my friends never asked me what her name was. Perhaps they knew all along she was Bryce. My friends also suggested I come clean. One of the major issues I discussed with my psychologist was a knee injury that prevented me from playing tennis for over a year. After the knee went, I got tennis elbow, ironically, bursitis in my hip, pinched nerve in my shoulders, and a whole slew of injuries that seemed like they would never go away. My therapist suggested I see a craniosacral therapist. In case you're wondering, craniosacral therapists work on healing of the mind and the body through alignment, energy, and light touch. So she gave me two names, Joni and Paul. She thought Paul was better suited for me because he was less hippy-dippy than Joni. I eventually made an appointment to see craniosacral Paul. I met Paul in his apartment in Beverly Hills. This not hippie had a ponytail and a studio most would confuse for a marijuana den. Jeez, how much of a hippie was Joni? Really? And so began Paul's and my craniotherapist patient relationship. Perhaps it was Paul's effeminate tone or the hot buff guy wearing a tank top in his apartment, but I concluded that Paul was probably gay, which made me feel I could open up to him, you know? A few sessions later, I asked his advice on the Bryce matter. Do I tell my best friend that I have romantic feelings for him? Paul said that he had friendships where he developed feelings, but out of respect for the friendships, he didn't say anything. His advice was somewhat contradictory to the other advice I was getting, but it was good nonetheless, as he had been in the exact situation. So, about that one industry town and its expectations. By April of 2007, I had lost 25 pounds and I had gotten my equity card. So my LA friends and I went out Saturday night to celebrate. I didn't want to do anything to ruin that night. So I decided if I was going to say something to Bryce, I would wait until after the party. That night started with just me and Bryce. We got dinner at our favorite LA hangout, The Grove. It was actually the only LA hangout we liked, come to think of it. Bryce paid to congratulate me. What a sweet guy. He then drove us to the bar where the rest of the folks were meeting us. I sure wasn't driving, as this was the first night I had drunk any alcohol since I'd been on this diet. We got to my favorite haunt in LA, Third Stop, and had a great time. My friends were very congratulatory about the equity card and the weight loss. My buddy Dan drove me back to the hotel I was living in at the time. I threw up, I went to sleep. It was a beautiful night. It was also the last night Bryce and I would be together without him knowing how I felt. I gave myself Sunday to get over the hangover and think things through. By the time I was driving to work Monday, I decided I was going to do it. So around the time I had left from, and the time it took to leave from Barham to Cahuenga, I gave Bryce a call and suggested we get coffee that evening. This was nothing new. I mean, we get coffee every week, but it usually wasn't on Monday. In any event, he agreed, and I began to lose my damn mind. At the time, I was a receptionist at a high-profile public relations firm that handled clients like Bill Cosby, Tony Orlando, and Cool from Cool and Again. I didn't have much distraction from my own thoughts at that job as the phone calls were sparse. So all day long, I sat at the front desk with my mind spinning and my stomach turning. Will this ruin our friendship? I don't think I can handle that. Oh, God. I'm about to tell my straight best friend that I have romantic feelings for him. I went over in my head ad nauseum what I would say and how I would say it. I was terrified about how he would react. Around 4 p.m. that day, something weird happened. Craniosacral Paul called me on my cell. I couldn't pick up as I was at work, but I listened to his voicemail. On it, he said, "Hey, Ryan, just calling to see how you're going, buddy. Give me a call back." I thought, how odd. This man was essentially a doctor to me, and I was his patient. Why was he calling me? We didn't have an appointment. Bryce and I had agreed to meet at his apartment before going to our usual hang in Santa Monica Earth Cafe. And on the drive from West Hollywood, I called Paul. This was back when every human being around Los Angeles was on a cell phone and there were no laws against it. These were the early Arnold days. Paul and I exchanged greetings, and then I asked, "Do you remember when I asked your advice on the last time?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'm pretty sure I'm going to go tell him how I feel." Paul said, "Well, everything you do is right, and I promise you'll be okay." I said, "It's so weird that you called today." He said, "I was picking up on your energy all day." I said, "I gotta call that kid." I said, "This is so crazy." He said, "Not really." "It's just life." If you need any more proof that craniosacral is the real deal after that, then something's wrong with you. Bryce answered the door in an extremely tight Chilean soccer jersey. It was hot. I was shaking. "I have to talk to you about something," I said as I entered his living room. He replied with a casual, "What's up?" I began to tell him that what I had gone over 100 times that day. I couldn't even look him in the eye. But I stood there with my profile to him, and I said, "I like you, and I don't expect anything from you, Bryce." And at this point, he sat down on the couch, and I continued, "And maybe there's something to be said for not saying anything and out of respect to the friendship, but I also think there's something to be said for, you only got one life, and life is short. And with how we've been joking around lately, it almost seemed like a possibility. But I just needed to know." I sat down on the love seat across from his couch. Bryce replied, "Either you're the best actor in the world or that was real." Right, because someone would put himself through that if it was I assured him it was. "You really think that would mess up our friendship, man?" he asked. I said, "Not mess it up, but maybe it'd be weird." He replied, "Maybe it'll be weird, but maybe it'll be weird for a while, but you're like my best friend. It's not going to mess up our friendship. In terms of a possibility, I'm flattered. I nodded, somewhat disappointed, but mostly incredibly relieved. Mm-hmm. He asked, "You still want to get coffee?" I told him, "Yeah," and then I had to pee. I went to use the bathroom, and when I came back, Bryce was still in the same position I left him, just sitting there, taking it all in. I had never seen him that still for that long. I joked, "April Fools!" Just kidding. Okay, I was going to say that would be a dick April Fools, Bryce replied. We got coffee that night. We talked, we laughed. We continued to do everything we did before, I told him. The only thing we never did again was pretend we were boyfriends at the cafes. But that was a small price to pay. If Bryce's reaction to what I told him wasn't going to be running into my arms, well, this was the next best thing. Though there was tremendous relief, there were some hardships in the months that followed. For instance, Bryce got this really annoying girlfriend. Though I knew I couldn't be with him, that did not stop my jealousy. One day, after I found out about Bryce's new lady, Tony Orlando called in the office to speak to his publicist assistant. I answered with the phone with Brokaw Company. Tony said, "Hey, Ryan, how you doing?" I said, "Jealous, heartbroken." This perhaps was not the most professional. Tony said, "Oh man, what happened?" I said, "She chose someone else over me." Yes, I was even using the "she" with Tony Orlando. He said, "Oh babe, you know what you do? I'll tell you what you do. I want you to take a pen, you got a pen? And write down this four-letter word, all right? I want you to write in big capital letters, N-E-X-T. All right, baby, all right, sweetie?" And that's what you do for every heartbreak. So, even when I was super down and out, Mr. Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around an Old Oak Tree knew exactly what to say. It wasn't long until I moved to New York and Bryce moved back home to Colorado, since we escaped. I visited him in Boulder and he visited me in New York several times. In September of 2011, I was the best man at Bryce's wedding in Venice, Italy. Thank God he found a woman far superior to that annoying girl he dated in Los Angeles. Just this past fall, Bryce and I went back to LA for the first time for our friend Jackie's wedding. Seeing friends and celebrating my 31st birthday and driving down Sunset with no obligation to stick around brought some nice closure to the 2 years I'd lived there. I got dinner at the Grove with Bryce and his wife, Julia, the night before the wedding, and Bryce asked, "Notice anything different about Julia?" I noticed her baby bump, and my jaw dropped. Bryce exclaimed, "You're going to be an uncle." These amazing moments wouldn't have happened if I never moved to LA, an experience which in the end taught me to be more open and more truthful. Oh, and to get rid of those stupid labels.
After battling cancer, sometimes it's the psychic scars that linger longest. In Re-Releasing the Confetti, Valerie David writes about giving herself the permission to live after struggling to just survive. Here's Ryan Holmes with Valerie's story of celebration.
December 31st, the eve of a new year full of promise and hope. Always been one of my favorite holidays. New Year's Eve, 1988. Knocking the boots with my college boyfriend Scott during the actual countdown. I was in ecstasy by the time we got to one Happy New Year! What a happy new year that was. New Year's Eve 1989. which was actually celebrated on January 6th. When my four college roommates and I got back to start our second semester senior year, we had a post-New Year's Eve party where I had previously taped the Times Square ball drop, with party hats, horn blowers, chips and salsa, and many kegs. We reenacted New Year's Eve all over again at the start of our final semester. We had so many people that snowy night crammed into our off-campus apartment, dubbed the Love Shack, after the B-52 song, that the creaky wooden balcony began to sag. 10:30 a.m. on December 31st, 1998, near the turn of the millennium, my fifth year living in New York City, I was waiting for the outcome of a biopsy from a mass in my chest. I was told that I would find out the test results on New Year's Eve day. I was spending the night in my cousin's fancy Park Avenue apartment with my parents. We had it all to ourselves, a quiet haven for much-needed privacy from my roommate and my own suffocatingly small pint-sized lair on the Upper East Side. I was in a flannel blue flowered nightgown that I borrowed from my mom. It looked like something along the lines of what Laura Ingalls wore on Little House on the Prairie, minus the bonnet. I remember it was a restless sleep. My mom and I were sharing the bedroom with the twin beds, my dad in the other room. This room was quadruple the size of my own. I was wearing gold wire-framed glasses with long, thick, greatly mussed curly brown hair cascading around my scared face as I turned to my mom that morning and said, "I know it's cancer." She answered, "Why would you think that?" I calmly replied, "I don't know. I just do." My cousin had telephones in three different areas of her gargantuan apartment. My unsteady hands dialed the number to the hospital pathology department, with my parents listening in on the other receivers. My heart was racing faster than Seabiscuit's gallop. A woman answered. I gave my name and asked to speak to the doctor on call, as never-ending butterflies flew out of my knotted stomach. Then I said, "I had a biopsy on December 27th for a tumor in my chest, and was told that I could get the results today. If at all possible, I would like to have them since my family is with me and it's holiday. I don't want to wait until after the new year." Then the receptionist's answer, "Just a minute." I was in full body shaking mode at this point. It felt like a million hours before another person came back. A man's voice responded. "It tested positive for malignancy." I couldn't comprehend the words. "What?" I said in a hushed tone. "It tested positive for malignancy. That's all the information I have," the cold voice re-announced. And he hung up, and that was it. Nothing like, "I'm so sorry to tell you this," or, "Don't worry, it will all work out," or, "You'll be fine, you're in good hands here." I let out a scream that originated from the depths of my soul. Not really a scream so much as a primitive guttural groan I never would have believed could come out of me. I dropped to the floor. "I knew it. I knew it was cancer," I moaned, uncontrollable crying, shaking my head no and rocking on the floor. My mother came rushing in into the bedroom and scooped me up, pulling me into her arms. "We are here for you. We love you. You will be all right. Don't worry. We will fight this." Then my dad came rushing in. He turned to console his youngest daughter, the baby of the family. He held me and with his serene, deep voice said, "It will be okay. Get a hold of yourself now. It will be okay." So here was the New Year's Eve ringing in for me now, and all that kept ringing in my ears was, "I have cancer. I have cancer. I have cancer?" I had plans that night to go to my friend Lillian's New Year's Eve party on Houston Street. My boyfriend, who took the news hard, and I both decided, "Fuck it, let's go. I'm not going to let this tumor stop me. I'm going to have fun, goddammit. Or at least pretend to. My group of friends at the party was aware I was to receive the news that morning. I arrived in my sexiest black shirt and tapered pants. I walked through the door with my head held high, my eyes drenched in cover-up and eyeshadow, masking their puffiness. Lillian and Paula came rushing up to me with hopeful eagerness in their eyes. I took a deep breath and quietly said, "We're not going to talk about it tonight." Their upbeat expression was now burdened with a deep sadness, and they nodded their heads in agreement. They knew. They understood. Tonight we forget. Tonight we celebrate. As the clock struck midnight, the year 1999 chimed in, and it flashed across the TV screen on Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve. I always loved Prince's song 1999 in high school, and couldn't wait to get to that year to fully party like it's 1999. In 1999? How cool is that? They say 2000 party's over, oops, out of time. So tonight I'm gonna party like it's 1999. Was I out of time now? Is this it for me? 30 years old. Was my life to end so soon, so suddenly? Suddenly there was not the joy I had of looking forward to this new year. It was now replaced with fear, apprehension, and uncertainty. Prince sings towards the end, "Don't you want to go? Don't you want to go? We could all die here today. I don't want to die. I'd rather dance my life away." My answer was, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to die. I'm not ready yet. The song that came on at the stroke of midnight was Madonna's Ray of Light. It was blasting at the party. I couldn't hold it in anymore. I erupted like a volcano and began to cry with my boyfriend at my side in the middle of the living room turned disco dance floor. Lillian and Paula hurried over, as the rest of my friends did, surrounding me, and Paula grabbed my face in her hands, and Lillian was stroking my hair. "It's going to be okay. We love you." Echoing the very same sentiments of my parents that morning. Everyone knew. We were all sobbing and hugging each other, and then we danced. We danced like it was the last dance of our lives. As the music escalated and Madonna chanted, "And I feel like I just got home, and I feel quicker than a ray of light, she's flying." Well, we all began to fly, dancing like possessed spirits, crazy, jumping up and down as if we were in a rhythmic explosion together, all in congruent movements and arm gestures. It was as if we were part of a tribe's traditional ritual dance of summoning. We were summoning, at that moment, a spirit to help me, to protect me, to cure me, exorcising my demons within. All the New Year's Eves since that evening locked me into a melancholy, bittersweet feeling. It did not mark the annual New Year's Eve festivities, but instead the anniversary of my cancer diagnosis. I did not feel the joy of New Year's Eve pasts. They were shrouded in an inexplicable mix of happiness, strongly laced with the sadness and pain of that day lingering in the back of my mind. New Year's Eve, 2004. It was almost 50 degrees, unusually balmy and more than welcome for this time of the year in the Big Apple. I was with a gang of friends watching the annual 4-mile Central Park midnight run sponsored by Emerald Nuts, with dazzling fireworks lighting up the sky at 12 o'clock. As I looked up at the explosions of multicolored illuminations before me, munching on the complimentary minuscule bag of nuts handed out, I saw couples hugging and kissing, and my friends beside me guzzling champagne from the bottles that were concealed under their coats. Without anyone noticing, my eyes welled up with tears at another year gone by, still haunted by the memory of 7 years ago. New Year's Eve 2012. I had gotten back together with my ex-boyfriend Andrew 2 months earlier. This December 31st, we had plans to drive up to Massachusetts to spend the holiday with his buddies. The night before, I was getting cold feet to go to this party and asked Andrew if we could just be with ourselves, just the two of us, because it was the first time we were spending the night together, and of course, most importantly, I wanted to celebrate my anniversary with him, someone I hope to spend the rest of my life with. And I hadn't met these friends before, and in contrast to my usual social self, I told Andrew I'd feel more comfortable alone with just him. He politely conceded. It was an incredible New Year's. We had a home-cooked dinner and ushered in the new year quietly and romantically. An amazing time. Then, a big shift in the spring. Andrew was not showing any gusto of moving forward. His same commitment issue coming full circle again, the reason for the relationship falling apart the first time around. We were not making any future plans, wedding or otherwise, and I wanted a future. During a couples therapy session, Andrew brought up that New Year's Eve. He told the therapist that he always goes to Massachusetts, and I backed out. He insinuated that because of me, he missed hanging out with his friends, which had really bothered him. And then said, "Valerie should really get over her cancer. Both my sisters had cancer, and they never talk about it." Shocked, I thought, being a cancer survivor is part of who I am. It always will be. His additional verbiage included that I can be clingy and needy, and he's a very independent person. But according to Andrew, I can handle her, though. Well, we broke up for the last time. New Year's Eve 2013, a banner year for me. I am now 15 years in the clear of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a milestone, cured of cancer. No more treatments, no more hospitals. This New Year's Eve, I ushered it in at my big sister's house in Maryland with my other sister, their husbands and children, my parents and neighbors. We all played the board game Pekino, a high-stakes bingo game that I have played with my family since I was 4 years old, each player contributing a dollar to the pot. Like I said, high stakes. We sniffed the red, white, and blue worn poker chips like we always did and joked how they still had that smoky smell from my grandfather's incessant chain cigar smoking. We laughed and cheered for my niece winning the coveted pot of $1 bills. We ate chips dunked in a thick Mexican bean and cheese dip, jalapeno poppers, and a million mini frozen quiches. The warmth of this evening eradicated the bitter below freezing temperatures outside. At the stroke of midnight, the adults clicked glasses of champagne with the plastic cups of sparkling apple cider served to the minors in the household. With a ripe red strawberry in it, I downed my whole glass in one shot. I finally felt released. This holiday became that happy, carefree, full of hope celebration all over again. Quicker than a ray of light, I'm flying. Happy New Year. And what a happy New Year that was.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this installment of Know You Tell It.
Visit us on the web at knowyoutellit.com.